mines, and Iraqi military base hosting U.S. troops comes under multiple rocket attacks amid growing anti-American sentiment. The Iraqi president pours praise on late Iranian commander General Soleimani for standing by the people of Iraq against terrorists. Palestinians hold a celebration after prisoner Hisham Abu Hawash ends his months-long hunger strike following a deal with Israel. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is the World News. Our top story for this half hour, U.S. military bases in Iraq have been the target of multiple attacks in the past 48 hours. We've spoken to Chief of the Baghdad Bureau, Navi Behrouz. He has the latest about the type and number of these attacks. Let's take a listen.
Hello and good morning. I have to tell you that early this morning we had witnessed an attack on the United States Victory camp near Baghdad International Airport. This attack was done by four Katyusha rockets. Iraqi officials say that these rockets have been fired from Al-Jahad region near the Baghdad International Airport and targeted this airbase. Of course, you know that U.S. forces are stationed in this airbase. This is the second attack on this airbase. Yesterday, there was a similar attack on this airbase using several drones, and Iraq has announced that these drones have been targeted, have been brought shot down. Before that, there was an attack on Ain al-Assad airbase using several drones, and this was a third attack. We also had two other attacks against a U.S. caravan, one in Yusufiya region near Baghdad, and another in Samawa province in southern Iraq. So in the past 48 hours, we had five attacks on U.S. forces in Iraq.
The Iraqi president hails Iran's national hero, late Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, for his valuable contributions to the uprooting of terrorists in the region. Barham Saleh says General Soleimani stood up for the people of Iraq when they were being brutally victimized by Daesh terrorists. Earlier today, Saleh and several high-profile current and former Iraqi officials attended an event in Baghdad to honor General Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Iraq's defense minister, Joma Inad, also addressed the event. He said the two personalities had the most pivotal role in the fight against Daesh. Both commanders lost their lives in a U.S. drone strike near Baghdad 2 years ago. A senior commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says the perpetrators who assassinated Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani will not be safe. Commander of the IRGC Quds Force, Brigadier General Ismail Qa'ani, says Tehran will never forget the martyrdom of Soleimani and his comrades. Qa'ani noted that Iran knows those behind the murder of the top Iranian commander, including former U.S. President Donald Trump and his Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and will retaliate in its own way. He said Tehran aspired for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from the region, but achieved more than that when Iraq expelled American forces in effect. The IRGC commander highlighted the soaring anti-Washington sentiments in Iraq and the growing calls for the expulsion of the 2,000 U.S. forces remaining there.
Iranians have paid tribute to Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, two anti-terror icons who were assassinated in a U.S. drone strike at the Baghdad airport on January 3, 2020. People from all walks of life participated in ceremonies across Iran to mark the occasion. they called for bringing the perpetrators to justice. Addressing a gathering in the capital, Tehran, President Ebrahim Raisi said former U.S. President Donald Trump, who ordered the strike, must be put on trial.
The then U.S. President must be put on trial as an aggressor, murderer, and the main criminal. He must face divine retribution. If Trump, Pompeo, and other criminals are not tried in a fair court for their horrible crime and are not punished for their shameful acts, I tell all American statesmen, do not doubt, Muslims will take revenge.
Similar ceremonies were held in other countries too. People in Iraq, Yemen, Palestine, and Syria held vigils and paid tribute to the top generals.
So he's seen as someone who put the country first, who did whatever was necessary, whatever he was called to do for his country, he did. He was described by many as an unassuming man, he wasn't arrogant, and that led to his personal appeal. But he's seen as a great hero in Iran and the surrounding area, and his record in defending the country and in leading the troops in different areas, different times, and even in peacetime, being responsible for the at least some of the military in Iran, has left the people with great memories of him and great respect for him.
In Lebanon, the Secretary General of the Hezbollah Resistance Movement said the expulsion of all U.S. troops from the region will be the ultimate revenge for the assassination of Soleimani and Mohandas. Said Hassan Nasrallah hailed the two figures, saying they played a key role in defeating Daesh terrorists in the region.
Iran's president was very blunt when it came to the role the two former U.S. officials played in the assassination. President Raisi said, if Trump and Pompeo are not tried in a fair court, Muslims will take revenge. The comment falls in line with what Iran's leader said days ago, that martyr Soleimani is more dangerous to the enemy than General Soleimani, because the likes of him will rise in the future.
Iran's ambassador and permanent representative to the United Nations has urged the UN Security Council to hold the United States and the Israeli regime responsible for the assassination of Iran's anti-terror commander, General Qasem Soleimani.
Given the dire implications of this terrorist act on international peace and security, the Security Council must live up to its charter-based responsibilities and hold the United States and the Israeli regime to account for planning, supporting, and committing the terrorist act. As I have on numerous occasions underlined, this internationally wrongful criminal act was a grave breach of the obligations of the United States under international law, and thus entails its international responsibilities.
Tahrawanchi stressed that General Soleimani played a significant role in combating international terrorism, calling his assassination a big gift and service to Daesh and other terrorist groups in the region. The Iranian diplomat noted that former head of the Israeli military intelligence, Major General Tamir Haiman, admitted last December that Tel Aviv was involved in the 2020 assassination and described it as one of the two significant and important targeted killings during his term.
The United States, unfortunately, has veto power in the Security Council and continually defends Israel from accountability for its many crimes against humanity and international war crimes and gross violations of human rights. So the fact that Israel was involved in the assassination of General Soleimani, which was ordered and carried out by the United States, is something the Security Council will never hold Israel responsible for.
The former official was apparently referring to Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, an Iranian nuclear scientist who was assassinated north of the capital Tehran in November 2020. Despite Iran's repeated calls on the international community to hold the perpetrators responsible for the dangerous adventurisms, neither the United Nations nor self-proclaimed promoters of human rights in the West have so far called for accountability or made any meaningful attempt to prevent similar attacks. Regardless, Iran has vowed to bring the perpetrators to justice and take revenge for the crimes they've committed.
Palestinians in the occupied West Bank celebrate a rare moment. Prisoner Hisham Abu Hawash ends his months-long hunger strike after reaching an agreement with Israel. A lawyer for Abu Hawash says Israel has agreed not to extend his detention beyond February 26. The Palestinian was arrested more than a year ago and has been held without charge or trial since then. He began his hunger strike over 140 days ago and was hospitalized in December when his health worsened. His release has sparked joy among Palestinians. His brother says this is a victory over the oppressive Israeli regime.
I can't describe how happy I am. Today we are happy for Hisham, who won over oppressive criminal Israel. Today, Hisham achieved victory for all the prisoners, martyrs, all the Palestinians, even for those who are in diaspora.
The agreement to release Abu Hawash follows big rallies that were held in his support across the occupied West Bank and Gaza. Resistance movements have also been threatening Israel with revenge. If he dies in jail, Abu Hawash is only one among hundreds of Palestinians who were being held in administrative detention. That rule allows Israel to keep the detainees for up to 60 days without charge, and then a court can extend the period indefinitely. Activist Mick Napier says Israel's decision to release Palestinian prisoner Hisham Abu Hawash after months of hunger strike shows that the regime is afraid of its consequences.
But in this situation, I think the important question is, why would Israel reach a deal with a man who was dying, was weak, could hardly speak, could hardly hear, after 140 days on hunger strike? Israel's afraid of these situations. But more than that, Israel knows that it's deeply unpopular internationally, and something like this could shine a light on their whole system. It's a remarkable moment. The lesson we take from this is that Israel can be defeated. And Hisham Abu Hawash is a tremendous example, a tremendous inspiration to all those fighting for justice.
The Yemeni army says it has downed a UAE drone in the central province of Shabwa. Army spokesman Yahya Sari says the unmanned aircraft was carrying out hostile actions over the Asilan district when it was shot down. For now, no further details are available. The United Arab Emirates is part of the Saudi coalition that's been waging a deadly war on Yemen for almost 7 years. The war has so far left hundreds of thousands of people dead, many of them women and children. But thanks to its growing domestic capability, the Yemeni army has managed to foil many of the attacks and even responded with retaliatory airstrikes against Saudi and Emirati positions. Well, Japan and South Korea say North Korea has fired an unidentified projectile, the first such test by Pyongyang in the new year. The Japanese Coast Guard was the first to report the launch, saying it could be a ballistic missile. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff says the projectile was fired from an inland location into the sea east of the Korean Peninsula. The details are so far sketchy. This is Pyongyang's first launch since it fired off a new submarine-launched ballistic missile last October. It's been only days since North Korean leader Kim Jong-un pledged to continue developing his nation's military to counter an unstable international situation. Meantime, South Korean President Moon Jae-in has been quick to react, saying he will not give up hope for dialogue with the northern neighbor. And we've reached out to our correspondent in Seoul, Jennifer Chang. She believes North Korea is in fact trying to engage the U.S. and make it back off on its uncompromising policy towards Pyongyang.
It is clear from today's missile test that it is going to continue the many weapons tests that we have been seeing since the second U.S.-North summit in Hanoi under the Trump administration fell apart. So this means that the U.S. is under even more pressure to engage with the North than it has been. They don't have many options other than engaging with the North and negotiating with the North on the North's terms. It has to be more flexible towards the North and stop its hardline policy of refusing to give any sanctions relief or security assurances to the North.
Far-right extremists reportedly continue to metastasize and recruit members in the U.S. despite a crackdown following last year's attack on the Capitol building. A research conducted by the Atlantic Council says some extremist groups have reorganized with a focus on local politics. It warns of the rise of far-right influencers in small social media platforms and the danger of radicalization. Far-right groups account for most domestic terror attacks in the United States. Last year's attack on the Capitol building put these groups under closer scrutiny. U.S. police have made more than 700 arrests in connection with the January 2021 attack on the Congress building. More than 500,000 people have signed a petition for former British Prime Minister Tony Blair to be stripped of knighthood, an appointment personally made by the country's monarch just last week. The petitioners say the former premier should be tried and jailed for his role in the illegal invasion of Iraq in 2003. Saeed Purazal has this report from London.
Britain's highest rank for chivalry, awarded by Queen Elizabeth to former Prime Minister Tony Blair, a man described by campaigners as one of the most repugnant political figures in the world, in power from 1997 to 2007.
The backlash to the announcement has been immense and is only growing. Furious Iraq War veterans are now calling for the honor system to be overhauled. And more than 500,000 people have signed a petition calling on the Queen to strip the man they call a war criminal of his new title.
It's a designation routinely awarded to former prime ministers here, but anti-war campaigners say they're repulsed at seeing Blair receiving it. And they have their reasons.
For millions of people in this country, it's an absolute insult, as it is to the people of Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and various other places where we've now seen the war on terror over the last 20 years. And I don't see any justification for it whatsoever. I think that Blair never conceded that he was wrong about any of these things. The Chilcot inquiry, which was very, very critical of him, he immediately held a very long press conference afterwards and said he would do exactly the same again.
In mid-February 2003, just before the Iraq invasion, tens of millions of demonstrators in hundreds of cities across the world, including in London, marched against the impending U.S.-led war in the Middle East. To Tony Blair, the biggest protest march in British history was fatuous.
The fact is that had we been listened to and had Britain not taken part in the war almost certainly would not have taken place, that America would have been much less likely to go to war alone. And we would have seen a much different world today, a day where far more people would be alive as a result of that war not happening, would be far fewer refugees.
The U.S. claimed the regime of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction and actively pressed for invading Iraq in late 2001. The weapons were never found. Two decades on, 1 million Iraqis dead, 3 million dispossessed, and a region reeling from terrorism and instability. Hundreds of British troops were also killed in the same conflict. Anti-war campaigners say Tony Blair belongs in the dock at The Hague and not in the pantheon of great leaders. Saeed Purazal of London.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Thank you. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Coffee's heritage can be traced back centuries ago to the ancient forests on the highlands of Ethiopia. Legend has it that an Ethiopian goat herder was the first person to discover these beloved beans in the 9th century. The shepherd found his missing goats energetically jumping around after eating some red berries. The goat herder then took his findings to the local monastery. From there, the monks discovered the beans helped them stay awake during night prayer. And so, coffee began a journey which would bring the beans across the globe.
Hello again and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the program that analyzes industries, markets, profits, and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This week we will explore the vast coffee industry as part of the food and beverage sector. We wanted to see where coffee comes from and check out its contributions to the national economy. So pour yourself a cup, get settled, and let's start the show.
Our journey took us to a commercial coffee roaster in the capital city of Tehran. Bon Mono was first established nearly a decade ago, and its products can be found in grocery stores, coffee shops, and online shops. This company makes several products, including drip coffee packets, coffee capsules for espresso machines, and general coffee for various brewing methods. But how does this roastery make its coffee? Well, it all starts with the beans. The raw green coffee beans are first selected by country of origin and then imported into Iran. And there are numerous countries that produce coffee, from the popular Colombian and Brazilian varieties to Kenya, India, and Indonesia, just to name a few. Green beans are then taken to the Quality Control Center for testing. This lab is equipped with the latest technology used to implement national standards for food safety and quality. It also adheres to international coffee standardizations for coffee flavor. At the lab, green beans are evaluated for their overall visual quality. Then they are roasted in test batches with a sample roaster ground and infused in boiling water at controlled temperatures. This is the stage where expert staff check the aroma, flavor, and look for flaws, such as over or under roasting. The coffee we enjoy each day takes a long journey to arrive in our cup. Coffee producers repeatedly test their products in order to maintain consistent flavor and quality throughout production. After determining the coffee bean characteristics and roasting temperatures, producers then blend different beans together, creating new flavor profiles.
The results from the lab tests are then passed on to roasting lines for that perfect roast.
At this stage, the coffee is ready to be fed to giant roasting machines. Typically, these machines are imported from Europe, but Chinese versions, which are also popular, are imported into the country too. There are three significant factors for a good roast: the type of bean, appropriate temperature, and duration of roasting. All of these steps in various ratios impact the final taste of brewed coffee. Then the coffee is taken to a storage facility where it can degas, and usually it rests there for about a month. After degassing, it is time for packaging. Each product requires its own specific type of containment. This roastery is able to produce tons of roasted coffee on a daily basis with consistent flavor and quality. Plus, it exports its products to neighboring regions too. The advantage of this company is that it distributes freshly roasted coffee nationwide while cutting out costly customs procedures and middlemen. This roastery also offers training courses in roasting, quality control, and other educational opportunities in the field of coffee production. Its philosophy is that by training and educating coffee producers, the general quality of coffee will also increase across the nation. In return, this generates healthy competition based on quality in the market. Coffee is cultivated in some 70 countries worldwide. Much of the world, in fact, gets its coffee from countries along the equator, a region that's warm and humid year-round. Most coffee is grown on elevations in areas with high humidity, where the majority of Arabica coffee comes from. You might be wondering whether Iran cultivates its own coffee or not, and the answer is yes, with a caveat. The Ministry of Agriculture has carried out several feasibility studies for the cultivation of coffee. The results suggest that natural cultivation of coffee is not cost-effective because Iran does not have vast spaces with ideal climatic conditions. But private farmers have been trying their hand in this matter, and some small-scale farms have popped up recently. These are mainly in Chabahar region of Sistan and Baluchistan province in southeastern Iran. Because of the moisture bellowing in from the Gulf of Oman and the warm, stable temperatures in elevations, some farms have been successful. Many private farmers have also begun using greenhouses to cultivate coffee. But in general, this method is also very costly, particularly since coffee is a water-intensive plant. A single coffee plant would need to soak up at least 400 liters of water daily for years in order to finally produce coffee berries. Some small farms have been able to harvest coffee, but this amount is still not enough to supply national demand. Going off of figures from Iran's Customs Administration, around 100,000 tons of green coffee beans are imported annually, valued at around $1 million. This figure is probably much higher because many small-scale importers do not register their purchases with the Customs Administration. Coffee has been around for centuries in the country. Evidence shows coffee was consumed as far back as the Safavid dynasty in the 16th century, and even back then it was imported. At some point in history, coffee imports became difficult and were replaced with tea. But coffee is a bitter beverage with a sweet profit, and its consumption is on the rise in the country. Iranians enjoy going out to eat as a leisure activity and a means of socializing. Coffee shops and cafes have become trendsetters for fashion and even philosophical exchange. Each city has hundreds, and in the case of the city of Tehran, thousands of coffee shops. But the coffee industry in Iran is still fairly new. A couple of years ago, the government restricted the imports of foreign coffee brands in support of local productions. The import of foreign coffee became more difficult, and now it is no longer economically justified. This led industry participants to move toward production to meet domestic demand. In general, Iran's coffee industry and market are rather fragmented, which is a reflection of how tea continues to be more popular. Much of the oversight for this industry comes from the Food and Drug Administration and the National Coffee Union. Coffee shop licenses are also issued by regional juice, ice cream, and coffee shop unions. In 2017, this union issued some 1,500 operation permits nationwide. Recent figures have not been published, and that number is likely much higher this year. There's so much untapped potential in the domestic coffee industry. Plus, there are numerous investment opportunities when it comes to cultivation and indigenizing roasting and grinding machines and brewing equipment.
All right, everyone, it is time for me to step aside for several minutes as my good friend and colleague is about to take you on another educational adventure. Enjoy.
E-commerce has been growing at a phenomenal rate throughout recent years. With the onset of the pandemic, an economic downturn loomed over companies and businesses on a global scale. However, amid slowing economic progress, the COVID upsurge resulted in an unprecedented spike in digital trade and online retailing. International e-commerce market accounted for 14% and about 17% of overall retail sales consecutively in 2019 and 2020. What's shocking is that figures and numbers in Iran's online retailing system do not seem to be following the same global pattern, even after the pandemic hardly hit our country. An Iranian team, Radar, notices this unusual pattern. Having noticed the problem, they now come up with their own creative idea.
The idea of creation of Radar started about 3 years ago. It was May or June at 2019, I think. We noticed a problem in the online retail in Iran. The problem we noticed was that why the percentage of online retail in Iran never goes higher than 1 or 2%. And the year before, despite of the presence of the coronavirus, this percentage never went higher than 3%. In comparison to the online shopping, online retail in other countries, in China or in European countries, about half of the population do the shopping through the online platforms. In Iran, in spite of the presence of technologies like 4G, even 5G technologies for communication, and online platforms, advanced tools that they present to the society, the percentage is the same, 2 or 3%. We did a lot of research, we did a lot of studies, and the only thing we found was that people need to be in connection. People need to be connected, interact with each other, and then decide to buy something online. What we did in Radar, we shift the priority. The first priority in Radar is interaction of people in they are in connected with each other. And the second one is the online shopping tools. And this is in this situation that we believe that percentage goes higher. If I want to tell you what is Radar, simple way, Radar is a platform fully interactional. People, users are fully connected, are in touch with each other. Sellers can be in touch with the customers. Customers are in touch with the seller. They can chat or talk to each other before every shopping. People are categorized in communities such as students, nurses, doctors, and so on. They can talk to each other, ask demand, and make a good decision before every shop. Even sellers in this platform and hire the people if they want to employ someone. They can hire through the communities that is there in the Radar itself.
The advantages of the platform, however, do not remain limited to what's been mentioned earlier. Some innovative and revolutionary virtual assets are designed and made accessible to users of the platform.
In Radar, we have some features to be mentioned that are really, really creative and revolutionary. Some of them are named Radarit. In Persian language, we called it Radarishkon or My City or even window shopping. For example, if I want to explain a bit about Radarit, you can send your requests, send your questions to all the sellers around yourself. or in another city or everywhere in your country before you buy a product online. Even you can choose the radius, you can choose the distance, and now he is the seller that should answer to your request. In this way, Radar is an on-demand platform that what matters is what you want, not what is sorted, what is listed in online stores. To explain our next feature in Radar named My City, or let's say in Persian, Shahreman, a society in which people are categorized in communities such as students, nurses, doctors, and so on. They can talk to each other, they can ask questions, answer to each other, and find everything you need to know before you make your online shopping. The next creative and somehow enjoyable feature of Radar is window shopping, or let's say in Persian, Bazargardi. By the use of this feature, you can virtually walk through the online store and have a look at the product, comparison the prices, and find what you want to buy online.
Radar is currently providing its services for free to all the retailers, a mission of high value to the whole team.
At last, I want to mention one valuable mission we have chosen for our company. Our mission is somehow interwoven with our CSR, or company social responsibility. We promote shops and sellers in our platform for free. We promote them to all the customers in the communities, in the province, and for the whole country. We help them to be visited more and to gain more customers and sell more.
With the potential for rapid growth, Radar is already very serious with its visions for the future. Visions from widening its market to providing the opportunity for international export in the long run.
About our vision in Radar, we have short-term vision, mid-term, and long-term vision. About the short-term vision, we are developing some creative and revolutionary features such as the merchant. We call it in Persian Bazargan. And our mid-term and long-term vision is to deliver and make accessible Radar for the neighbor countries and next to the whole world.
Competing in the retail market on a global scale might not seem like an easy task for an Iranian online platform, but serious with its visions and meticulous with its ambitious plans, Radar seems to be right on its way to fulfill such objectives.
Well, there's still so much to cover and so little time. So now let's dive right into some interesting developments and trends in coffee industry. There are scores of coffee enthusiasts in the country who are eager to put their coffee knowledge to the test. Each year, a national coffee competition is held where roasters from across the country come to compete.
This competition is held by the International Coffee Festival, and participants sign up to showcase their barista and roasting skill. Over the course of a couple days, competitors demonstrate their cupping, roasting, and green bean analysis abilities in front of a panel of judges. Other competitions, such as latte art, are also held. This event provides a platform for networking and career development for competitors. It also helps promote different varieties and coffee origins by bringing them onto the international stage.
It seems that making coffee and drinking it is simple enough, but there are nuances in coffee processing, roasting, and brewing that all add up to that perfect cup of coffee. And to understand more, there are coffee schools to help with that.
These schools offer barista training, courses on artisan coffee, or just consumer coffee classes. The curriculum is geared towards everyone, including entrepreneurs in the process of starting a coffee business. The training centers are fitted with state-of-the-art espresso machines and brewing equipment, as well as roasting machines and so much more. These schools also offer certification for international standardizations too. There are several coffee schools in Iran, but the most famous ones are in the capital city of Tehran.
Coffee can be a rewarding hobby. While many drink coffee for its taste and caffeine, there are some who see coffee differently. For years, an Iranian artist has been using Turkish coffee to create surreal modern paintings.
Odak Jamshidzadeh uses coffee as watercolor on canvas. First, the artist spills coffee on the fresh surface. Whatever shape the spilled coffee stains take becomes the base of his new painting, which he refines with more detail. Most of his paintings are improvised and created on the spot without prior planning. There are few artists who paint with coffee this way. The artworks of this painter have been displayed in several national and international exhibitions over the years.
And that wraps up our program for today. We'll see you next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
شیخ کاظم علی.
اعوذ بالله من الشیطان اللین و رجیم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم و بهی نستعین و صل الله علی سیدنا محمد و اهل بیته الطیبین الطاهرین. اللهم صلی علی محمد و آل محمد و عجل فرجهم. I welcome you all to IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program For Humanity, and today's topic is human rights. We've discussed so far about the term human rights. We mentioned the natural rights about it. We mentioned how it's derived from the natural law. We mentioned about John Locke's approach to bringing down the natural law to the sovereign, the ruler of the state. And we mentioned how he mentions that if the ruler is not able to protect the life, liberty, and property of people, they have the right to overthrow this ruler and establish a new state. We looked at the United States Declaration of Independence. We mentioned about how being created equal, what it means in the Western point of view, what it means in the Islamic point of view. And we also mentioned that the human rights concept came in the Western world in the 15th and 16th century, whereas it existed in Islam right from the advent of life, and it grew into a more complex and a more developed form of human rights as the religions grew from Janab Adam alayhi salam all the way to our Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. We saw a couple of verses from the Holy Quran, and then we mentioned that how the Western culture has influenced their understanding of human being, and how that has influenced in how that has influenced them in formulating the human rights, how it has influenced their ideology, their mentality in formulating the human rights. And these human rights are so specific to the Western approach of life, and they do not complement the culture and the approach of the Eastern way of life. And that's why you will see countries like India, Japan, China, Malaysia, they've raised their voice against the Western concept of human rights and said that your concept of human rights, your treaties of human rights, does not conquer, does not complement, does not comprehend with our culture and our way of life. We mentioned the example of Iranian representative to the United States, Sayyid Rajai Khorasani, where he mentioned that the human rights treaties that you have is a secular understanding of the Judeo-Christian tradition, and this cannot be implemented in the Muslim world. And this is where we understand that they have perceived human being as a materialistic person, based on the philosophies and the ideologies that existed in their world, in the Western world, which promoted the positivism, which promoted the materialism, and based on that, they derived their human rights. And we see that these human rights complement their own ideology and the worldview of materialism, and does not complement the ideology of Islamic view of human beings, where human has being identified as a dual dimensional entity, where human beings have body and soul, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala emphasizes upon the soul of the human being rather than just paying attention to the body of the human being.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
So, the flaw with the current human rights strategy that we see that is prevailing in the world is that the implementation of the human rights by the Western world is only limited to their own countries. If you look at
the implementation of human rights, you will see that they've excluded all the third world countries when it comes to implementation of human rights. Though they mention that as part of UN Assembly, they go out and support these weak countries and they show pictures and videos of it. But in true sense, you will see that they only limit these human rights to their own countries and have excluded all the third world countries. You will see that from the 17th century, this is where you would see that these Western countries started invading various countries around the world, right from Japan to China to India to Africa to other regions to Madagascar and Asian countries, and they looted them. They looted the countries, they took the gold, they took the oil, they massacred the people. If you look at the Red Indians, they went to America, they massacred the people. They came to India, they massacred the people. They went to China, they massacred the people. They dropped atomic bombs on Japanese and killed hundreds and thousands and millions of people, right? And they don't care for human lives the way they have been talking about human rights, saying that they have a right to life, they have a right to choose, they have a right to be happy. And this is what they mentioned in their Declaration of Independence in the 17th century. And you will see that right in those timelines, they had organized and orchestrated famines in India, in Iran, and other Middle Eastern countries, causing millions of people to die. Look at the invasion of Iraq. Under the pretext of saving Iraqis from Saddam, they invaded Iraq with a political agenda, calling it human rights intervention, and literally destroyed Iraq. They took all the gold from Iraq, they took all the oil from there, and they took it all for themselves, for their own countries, for their own benefit, not for the benefit of the Iraqis. If they had invaded Iraq to liberate the Iraqis from Saddam and help them develop and grow, then they should have reverted back all this gold and oil to the Iraqis and helped them develop their country. But you will see that their focus, their agenda, their goal is implementation of human rights for their own people and not for anybody else. And that's why they have excluded the third world countries from it, and they are now only focused on the human rights to their own people. So this clearly shows that their theory of human rights is biased, and it is biased for their own people and not to all mankind. The way they propose it, the way they present the propaganda, the way they promote it, it's not for all mankind, it's only for themselves. And that's why you see that even today they have sanctions for countries like China, just because they're challenging the technical progress of the Western world. Just because China is progressing, they are challenging the technical development, they're challenging the medical development. You will see Western countries like America, Britain, France, they have sanctions against China. And look how they have manipulated Africa and took away all the riches, and these riches are being used for the benefit and development of the Western world. Inshallah, we will look at these concepts and some more questions in our next episode. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, we hope you enjoyed the program For Humanity. If you have any comments or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
O mountains of Mecca, you were there when the Prophet Muhammad climbed down in despair. Engraved in his heart were the words of his Lord. To all of mankind, this was his call. La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. O people, praise only Allah, glorify Allah. Of Mecca, bear witness that I to the oneness of Allah do I testify. For all that He's given me, how can I deny? My purpose in life should be only to cry. La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. There is no God but Allah.
Muhammad is his messenger.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.